Hello, you're listening to Queer Everything, a queer of color podcast about thriving in the world while being at odds with it. I'm Lena Rafiq Sheikh.
My guest today is Paul Nabil Mathis, whom you can find on Instagram and TikTok as @PaulNMathis, Mathis with two T's. Paul is an author, musician, and social media educator, among other things. Paul's channel is great. He posts a variety of educational videos, ranging from topics in Middle Eastern and Swana history, to nerdy videos about different percussion styles in the Arab world, to social justice topics, to the history of science, and, most recently, helpful content about what is happening right now in Palestine, which I particularly want to highlight as a resource. I found one of his videos a couple of years ago on TikTok, where he has 87,000 followers, and thought, wait, I know this guy. We went to high school together in Bahrain. I'd originally invited him on the podcast to talk about a wonderful series he did about the history of queerness in the Sawana region for Pride Month. Paul is a cis straight man, half Syrian on his mother's side, white American on his father's side, and I love the way that he models using his privilege to educate people. As I was about to release that episode, horrific events started unfolding in Israel and Palestine that by today, on October 27th, 2023, look increasingly bleak. I saw Paul had been posting about what was happening, and so reached out and asked if he wanted to chat about that too. In the videos, he does things like break down confusing rhetoric around this, distinguishes between Judaism and Zionism, and offers historical background and down-to-earth, fact-based analysis of the situation. I'm releasing both conversations today as a double-length episode, with the Palestine one first. So in this first part, we talk about what he's been posting about Palestine and the response he's gotten, both positive and negative. And he also offers his thoughts as a social media educator on the kind of rhetoric we're seeing around this, shadow bans and repression of posts, and his strategies for sharing on various platforms. In the second part, we talk about the Queer Sawana History TikTok series, as well as his experiences living in the United States and the Middle East as a Syrian American, and how he handles trolls on his social channels. And I couldn't resist asking him to take out his drum and talk us through some of his favorite Middle Eastern beats. Because we recorded that one back in August, the tone is obviously different. Y'all, I don't know what we're living through right now. My heart is with everyone that is affected, everyone looking on in horror, and everyone doing their damnedest right now to raise their voices and show up in this moment as best that they can, to do what they can, and to educate people. Right now, it is an act of bravery at personal risk to declare where you stand. And all I can say is keep speaking up, keep being brave, and keep raising your voices. With love, rage, and solidarity, free Palestine. I am here with Paul Nabil, who you'll hear the entirety of our conversation that we recorded a couple months ago in the next episode. Paul, welcome back.
Hello, thank you. Good to be here again.
Good. Paul, thank you for agreeing to do this at short notice. So Paul and I were texting in the wake of what has been happening in October of 2023 in Israel and Palestine. And because Paul has been posting vocally TikTok and educating people, I invited him back to come and talk to us a little bit about his perspective on what's happening and how he's educating people. So, Paul, would you introduce yourself briefly again and then talk a little bit about your social media activities?
Sure. My name is Paul. I was born in Texas to Texan dad of, eventually, if you go far enough back, Welsh descent and a Syrian mother. And so I lived overseas in the Middle East for a little bit as well, a little bit in Saudi, and then also in Saudi and in Bahrain. Syria, Saudi, Bahrain, I don't know what you said. And then I've been back in the States ever since. I'm a musician and a writer, and I am pretty active on TikTok and Instagram. And usually if you just search Paul Nabil, I'll come up pretty quick. So I grew up visiting Syria and hearing about the Levant and its history from my mom, and feel pretty passionately about it.
You and I know each other because we overlapped for that 1 year in Bahrain. Mm-hmm. And then I found you on TikTok 25 years later.
Yeah.
And yeah. Here we are.
And so yeah. It goes.
And so it goes. So as folks will hear in the next episode, originally I had interviewed Paul about the wonderful series he did on queer history in the Sawana region, the Middle East, in the Arab world, really, mm-hmm. Arab Muslim world. And in the past few days, everything is on fire and social media has exploded with material about what is going on over there. And as I have with so many of your other educational videos, I've really appreciated the stuff you've been posting lately on Israel and Palestine, what's happening in Gaza. So, yeah. So, I don't know. I'm curious. How have the last few days been for you? And what have you decided to post about? And how have the responses to what you've been posting been?
So, it's definitely a process, as is everything. I think the first day or two, I didn't post anything. We were all just kind of like glued to our phones, TVs, laptops, watching things play out and knowing with dread the general playbook as these things go, knowing what was coming, which I think was getting a lot of people to freeze up. So I originally just made a post, I guess just trying to, because immediately the knee-jerk reaction in particular, and I'm just going to use the phrase Western media as a problematic but difficult to replace phrase to describe the vernacular of that, not just English speaking, but kind of like centered around that part of the world. Western media kind of have like a knee-jerk reaction, and the same is true of, I think, a lot of just general celebrities and public figures, which has always traditionally taken the safer route of supporting Israel and treating all Palestinians as terrorists. So the counter rhetoric there was a little hard to find your footing at first. So I just posted trying to explain to people that whatever you're going to hear in the coming days, just remember that you'll see some terrible, horrible things, whatever those things are. But this is, in the end, discussion about oppressed versus oppressors, and oppressed people, especially the longer they are oppressed, will do increasingly desperate things. So that was just how it started. And then I moved a little more into what is generally more my purview, which is I talked a little bit about history, historical standpoint, just trying to share general terminology outside of knee-jerk religious rhetoric that people tend to get into. You know, whose land is it and that kind of a thing. 4,000-year-old religious narratives versus 75 years of establishing an ethno-state. That kind of a thing. And then I would probably say even from there, if you know your social media theory, starts with emotional. This wasn't deliberate. I just noticed myself doing it. It starts with like an emotional plea, and then you get into educational factual stuff. And after that, you get into messaging. As everybody speaks on this and more things seem to be said over and over again, then you get into the meta and you look into how do we continue to talk about this while maintaining as safe a space as we can for the people that we want to maintain a safe space. So I guess that's kind of where I'm at right now. And then I'm gearing up, I think, to do a couple more factual historical posts coming up soon. But those always take kind of preparation and research and a lot of meticulousness to make sure that we don't get into anything disrespectful, hateful, bigoted, harmful for anybody involved. So that would be the long answer of of what I've been posting on recently. What else did you ask? You asked me more than that. Oh, how was the response been?
Yeah.
Should I just keep ranting or?
Well, a couple of things to what you said. Not everybody's on TikTok. I mean, I'm a little bit afraid of TikTok personally.
Rightfully so.
I have like 7 accounts that I follow and I don't scroll it. I find it overwhelming and quite stressful. For people who may not be able to access your videos, I thought a couple of them in particular, I thought they were all great. And then the ones that I found myself forwarding were, for instance, one of the terminology ones where you're distinguishing between Zionism and Judaism.
Right.
And then the other one was the one that you just posted very recently, which was, so this is why I'm interested in rhetoric. So the one, so I reposted the one that you posted very recently, which is, you know, a lot of people are saying, oh, I can't post on this because I don't understand enough. So they're staying silent.
Right.
And that silence is, you know, really impactful. So
yeah. So in a previous video, I had just kind of said slightly offhand that just because you don't know every in and out of the history or the nuance, whatever, what I said previously, fairly clear, which is collective punishment is a war crime, and asking over 1 million people to evacuate a tiny section of an open air prison and then bombing the exit you told them, the only exit that they have available to you that you told them to go to. That's not entity working in good faith. So it's one of those things where it's like, I understand that you feel a little lost and confused, but you also have to understand that confusion is a weapon, because people who are on the side of Zionism, who spend a lot of their time practicing debating this subject and internalizing the propaganda, or just being, you know, brainwashed from when they were very young people, in order to combat somebody who is just coming into the conversation, they will try and overwhelm you with all these confusing facts and whatever. But if you just look like the facts of what's happening in Gaza right now, the situation is clear, and just support and publicly show your solidarity right now. Don't let all the confusing stuff kind of distract you from publicly expressing your support. And when this is over, whenever this is over, then we can start working towards a more broad, nuanced understanding of what is happening there.
I appreciate that what your videos do is offer people context, facts to inoculate themselves against this.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in the response, including from people who are, as you say, debating and kind of intimidating people who are first coming into this and trying to sway public opinion that way.
Sure. Very important to make sure that we're clear here is I do have a very diverse and generally pretty awesome following. I'm fortunate to be able to say that. And that includes quite a lot of members of the Jewish community, be that more secular Jewish community or rabbis and all these people I'm connected to and friends with. And obviously, I have had to block a few more people than usual recently for one reason or another. But I think that it's a combination of we're all here to try and get to the most basic kernels of what's happening and what's going on and how to discuss it and how to move forward with everybody being at each other's throats right now. And so we all want people to be talking about this from whatever faction or side of the aisle or whatever you want to come from. So I would say that generally people can see that I'm approaching this respectfully and not from a hateful standpoint. I did have, so for example, aside from just straight up bigotry, which I tend to just, and slurs and that kind of crap, which I just block, you know, and then there's just knee-jerk reaction people that they're not really worth engaging with. They're just trolling you. There's also some real discussion. Historically, I always try and remember to say like modern Zionism or political Zionism or whatever phrase you want to do, to be more specific, but I've been talking about it so much I became remiss, and I was just saying Zionism, Zionism, and Judaism is not Zionism, and there's different interpretations of whatever. And so one of my Jewish friends was actually like, hey, you haven't made the distinction in a while that Zionism is actually several different concepts, not just the belief in the establishment of an ethnostate. And so, which I immediately responded to that and said, this is great. I said it in passing, but here's a post just about the fact that plenty of people in the Jewish community don't identify with any aspect of Zionism. So other than kind of like the more distant when the Messiah comes back sort of a thing, but there's purely religious standpoint having nothing to do with the political stance. So we all, I think in general, make each other better and do our best to approach respectfully. And the blocking is free. Blocking is self-care. You don't need to engage with the trolls. And if someone isn't quite being so bad that I feel like blocking them, they actually are engaging, get into like some big, long debate, 100 comments long. And a lot of times I just don't read those. I've told my friends to please tag me if the comments get crazy or if the comments get too wild, just to tag me if someone says a slur or something and I miss it. I'll just go block them to try and keep my comment section as safe as possible. So it is active, but also there's a way to be actively diligent to keep the discussion safe while also taking into consideration what you can and can't handle and maintaining your own mental health however you can. So look away from your phone, put it down, tell people that they're, please inform you if you miss something that's harmful that's being said. It's kind of a communal approach to the discussion, because there really are plenty of people out there who, just like me, have a completely different background than I do, who are active in the Jewish community or with openly anti-Zionist Jewish organizations. We all just want people to stop being murdered first and foremost. And that's, I think, what we focus on through trying to inform people as best we can.
I mean, I have seen your videos posted around, and I'm curious what the
general response has been, not just in the comment section? What kind of feedback have you gotten?
It's interesting because obviously all of our social media, to one extent or another, uses these algorithms to, they work in this kind of push-pull method of, in one, you're siloed in your little bubble, everybody who agrees with you, but then also people fighting drives engagement. And so just kind of this pendulum swing of some posts are, they're fine. And then other ones, you know, that your comments turn into a total shit show. So I would say that I think the worst response that I've gotten so far is I made a post specifically about how a lot of pro-Israel, pro-Zionist rhetoric is explicitly or in a more hidden way trying to imply that Israel is united in the horrific treatment of the Gazans, which is very much not the case at all. And there's this old adage of, if you want to be the most successful door-to-door salesman you can be, don't even bother with the sales pitch. Just when you knock on the door, tell them that everybody else in the neighborhood has already bought one. And I think that is maybe one of the, you know, causes the most backlash from pro-Zionists, ultra-nationalist Israelis, is implying that they're not unified, because they very much are not. Of course, there's a huge amount of dissent in Israel about what Zionism even means in 2023, to say nothing of the horrific mistreatment of Gazans and Palestinians in general. So trying to point out that, in fact, there is plenty of dissent about this just within the community of Israeli Jews, I think it some folks really upset, and I got some pretty hateful comments on that one. It's interesting what some things they'll see and say they won't even respond to, and then other things, not always the most intuitive thing, will really kind of like draw a lot of vitriol.
Interesting. What do you make of that?
Honestly, a lot of the discussion that people want to have is really old information that has been rehashed a million times. They've heard it all before. And a lot of people have automatic responses to that one way or the other, and they're not going to be convinced. But I think one of the true tenets, because Zionism is Israeli nationalism. So that is it's like an equal sign. Modern Zionism. I'm just trying to catch myself. Modern Zionism. That's what it is. It's nationalism. And the whole point of nationalism is we are united as a nation. And so as soon as you imply non-unitedness, you know, the concept starts to break down. So
it's threatening. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
And then positive response?
So I've had, honestly, a very overwhelmingly positive response. Obviously, a lot of my friends are Arabs or, you know, or Pakistanis, or I have a fair amount of Irish friends. And you and I were just talking about my beloved South African followers through various, a couple of viral posts that just kind of hit back in the day. So those are all people who understand what I was saying earlier about when you're in a desperate situation against someone who is much more powerful than you, which nobody denies there's a massive power imbalance between the Israeli government and Palestinians. So some communities, even outside of the Middle East, Arabs or whatever, will look at that and just immediately get it. I did make a post calling out the Irish Mirror for really just, they had an updated graphic because people were sharing an old graphic that didn't show the whole story. But I also just said, just read this article. It's just a normal article from the Irish Mirror. There's no harmful language in it towards Palestinians, which is so hard to find. It wasn't even biased reporting. They report just as equally on Palestine and Israel atrocities. But the language that they used was so considerate and so understanding and non-dehumanizing. They considered the humanity of the oppressed people in the situation, because I think they have a national memory of what happens when you're just brought to the brink of desperation. So a lot of overwhelmingly positive response, much more positive response now that I'm seeing than maybe ever I've ever seen in terms of Palestine, because it's just getting harder and harder to control a narrative online anymore.
Yeah.
I really think that Israel's, at least as far as I can tell from my little bubble, my little silo, it does seem a little bit like they're losing the public opinion struggle that they tend to be so much better at in the past. So maybe a bit of a silver lining amongst all the rest of the horrors.
I mentioned to you that I picked up and forwarded some of your posts. I appreciate how clear and concise they are. I appreciate that you're speaking to an audience, I think, of people who want to do better, aren't equipped with what they need, or you are equipping them with a few things that they need. I appreciate hearing you talk about how you think about social media and what is and isn't changing. Past little while, I've noticed a lot of people wondering, I think rightfully, if their postings are being suppressed, for example, shadow banned. People notice that, oh, when I post about this topic, I get 10 times more viewers than I do when I'm posting about Palestine. What is your thinking about that?
So I do try to make a distinction between suppression and shadow banning. Mm-hmm. In general, it is almost always suppression and almost never shadow ban. And it's kind of in the vernacular, especially on TikTok. TikTok and Twitter are the two big ones, the app formerly known as Twitter. The shadow banning is pretty rare. Suppression is common. Mm-hmm. So shadow banning is actually, if you trace it back, it comes from alt-right conspiracy theories on Twitter, which is you can see your post, but nobody else can, or almost nobody else can. Mm-hmm. Suppression is very common, but it doesn't generally happen in the sort of conspiratorial way that people often tend to suggest. It is almost always algorithmically driven because algorithms are driven by people and people are prejudiced. So absolutely, the algorithm unfairly suppresses POC creators. And the reason is because the majority of people who control that algorithm don't like seeing POC creators, right? It's depressing and it's annoying. And there are ways to fix it that many people aren't taking. But it turns out also that several factors can drive content suppression, and one of them is tragedy fatigue. So trying to continue to talk about an ongoing tragedy, don't write that down, that's my term for it. Whenever a tragedy does not directly affect somebody, or at least they don't think it does, or it doesn't affect them in a direct way, or like an obvious way, as time slowly goes on, they will scroll past content about it faster and faster, because they know that if they just ignore it, the bad feelings it gives them go away, right? And the algorithm will immediately adjust to that and saying, this the flavor of the week, we've moved on. Let's go on to Pete Davidson's new girlfriend instead. So unfortunately, that's also a big part of it. And on TikTok, at least, most places, but I know how it works best on TikTok, which is mass reporting. Unfortunately, there is absolutely very large and organized online groups tend to be pro-Israeli. I'm sure there are the pro-Palestinian ones as well, but it's not a secret. It's actually quite well documented. Like, you have things like Canary Mission that are basically large groups of pro-Israeli, pro-Zionist, ultra-nationalist Israelis who target anybody who speaks out against Israel and Zionism. And one of the ways that that exists on TikTok is they will generally have a forum, usually something like a Discord server, and they will share any post that is anti-Zionist, and then they will say, go attack this person. And they will mass report, they'll try and get your video taken down, they'll try and get your account banned, and they'll spam you with hate comments. I've certainly gotten those comments, and it's extremely obvious, particularly because they copy paste the same responses. So you'll just get however many different users all just spamming you with the copy pasted hate speech on your posts and that kind of a thing. And sometimes those posts will have a temporary ban. And it's a very effective policy, because once your post is flagged due to too many content violations that people are reporting you en masse, it can get taken down until you appeal. And then the appeal is accepted. So then your video comes back up, but it's already too late. The video has missed the wave, and then it gets no attention. So there are very technical and effective ways that people in general who disagree with you can make it very difficult for a particular video or post or account to be successful in the in the wild west that is trying to wrangle an algorithm these days.
Okay.
So I don't personally ascribe to theories that an organization like TikTok is purposefully suppressing Palestinian voices. I know that other organizations have done that. New Twitter certainly does. We know Facebook has, and a lot of that is more tied to who are their biggest sponsors and business partners than any actual political affiliation. But that's part of the reason that I don't engage with those platforms as much, because I don't think that they're fair. I think TikTok has a problem with audience and auto mod, but I don't think that as an app, it's purposefully suppressing any voices in particular. And that's, you know, just from my opinion, like, you know, an experience on the app.
Instagram?
So I don't post everything that I post to TikTok to Instagram. For a long time, Instagram was just for drumming videos. But I had some people who follow me on both platforms specifically ask me to start posting stuff, cross-posting over to Instagram as well.
Yeah.
So I'm actually pretty new to trying to post political content to Instagram. And I don't know, I'm less familiar with that as a political platform because I honestly think zero people go to Instagram to have their minds changed, which is not the case on TikTok. TikTok people are really there to listen and learn. Instagram, I think it's because it's a Meta property. It's just Facebook too. People go there to argue with each other and not really learn anything in particular. I guess Reels is a little different. I don't have enough experience with posting. What I'm saying is I only just started posting, you know, quote unquote controversial posts to Instagram since the last few days. So I haven't noticed any like direct suppression of my content. One of my first posts, I think it's at 30 something thousand views now. So I think it's probably going more the TikTok route, which is, hey, free engagement means get it out to more people. And that's more people who see our ads and they don't care what the post itself actually says.
Interesting. Now, okay. So I hear you about the tragedy fatigue. I mean, that's real. There's certain accounts that I follow and I have to scroll past them because they're really graphic videos that are being posted. I still follow it and I still try to engage. And it's hard.
Yeah. Who can sit there and just watch video after video of, you know, dead young people? Like it's horrifying. And some accounts I think are going to choose that route. And some of them don't even put a content warning or any warning or anything like that, you know? So everybody has their own approach. Some people really just want to elicit an emotional response. It's important that there is some documentation of that cruelty, obviously, but I'm not a journalist. I identify first and foremost as an online educator. So I try really hard. In this case, I do not remain unbiased. I certainly do and always will side with Palestine in the struggle. But I am not going on there and trying to emotionally tug people one way or the other. I am giving the information and hopefully showing people how I reached the decision that I did through the reality of the situation and not how one side or the other wants to present it, just to try and emotionally convince you of that their side is correct. So, and I just think that's less tiring for people than just these constant videos just to shock you and swing you one way or the other. Like I said, that other stuff is necessary, but eventually someone's going to just shock you the other way if you don't have the facts to back up what you just saw that tugged on your heartstrings. That's my personal opinion, approach, research, and whatever you want to call it.
But you said about TikTok being a platform where people go to listen and learn. That's interesting.
Oh, yeah.
I know that some of the more interesting discussions are having on it, and I haven't heard the platform characterized that way. So I appreciate that.
Oh, yeah. I cannot emphasize enough how much you will learn on TikTok if you go there to learn things. There's different regions. The biggest part of TikTok is still comedians and dancers, but that's 40% of TikTok. And the rest of it is just all these other little factions and regions of that algorithmic digital space. And one of them is hashtag edutalk, EDUTOC. And it's longer videos with accessible captions and no or very little music. And it's just people giving you free and open source and decentralized and often extremely expert and niche educational content. And that's the space that I exist in. It's closely related to civil rights and social justice, because oftentimes education is the first step to people confronting their own biases. So it really is different platform. It's kind of like short form educational YouTube content, and it's a really powerful medium. And people who still think it's just dancing, I strongly encourage you to just go on there and just find the educational content. And I promise you, and within the first day or two, you'll see something that you never thought of before, and that will change the way you think about something in your life. It's a very different sort of social media platform. TikTok, pay me.
That's good to know. That's not something I knew about. I mentioned to you when we started talking today that I just find it so overwhelming. It's like opening this thing and like having just things blaring at me. And yeah. I hear you about curating. You hear about so many suspect things on TikTok. There's the dancing, and then there's also the, you know, suspect nutritional advice.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Shopping, perineum sunning, all sorts of weird shit. Like,
I've seen those, yeah, back in the day when it was still trying. Yeah, no, you'll find some wild shit on there too. But yeah, it's hidden among all of the memes and you know, Pokemon content, you will find some gems. But actually, the kind of joke is like the FYP knows you better than yourself because their algorithm is just so much better than any other platforms. So you'll go on there and you think that you're like, oh, I'm super interested in history. Let's learn about history. And then like a week later, you're like, so I guess I do have ADHD. I should probably see a doctor about that.
That's funny. Just in terms of strategies for people who want to intervene, you know, want to get the word out on social media, like, how do you think about this? I'm seeing some people posting useful things about how, like, different kinds of content, like how not to get suppressed. I don't know. What advice do you have?
Right. So Instagram, I think, is a little more, you have a little more freedom to post about what you want. And again, I'm not really, I've said goodbye to Twitter and Facebook, but Instagram.
Me too. Yes.
You can kind of be less careful, in my opinion, on Instagram. You'll get worse comments and worse trolls. So you have to prepare for that. But they are not nearly as draconian with like their hashtags, with profanity, with like sexual content, you know, with violent content. Instagram will allow much, much more of that. TikTok, now and for always, is mostly targeted towards like the 13-year-old to like 18-year-old age range. It drives adults who try to use the platform nuts. But it really is geared toward, like, you have to in your head think, you know, when you were 13, you know, you might have been swearing and talking about whatever you were, so it's not like you have to keep it all Care Bears, but you have to keep in mind that you cannot hashtag a lot of profanity or graphic, you know, content of any kind, which is going to make it difficult to talk about, you know, violent things happening to a group of people such as the Palestinians. So, you know, I'm fortunate to not have had to dealt too much with community guidelines and such. Part of that is because I am straight cis white man. And so people don't see me as quite as easy of a target. So I just don't get targeted as much by hateful people and trolls. But also, in addition to that, just always try and keep in mind what I can and can't get away with in terms of what I show, what I say, and tag and describe all my posts as. So just be wary that TikTok really does very strictly moderate all of their content with a very young audience in mind. It's much more intense than, like, you know, Instagram or anywhere else. So, and certainly than Twitter. So, yeah.
Good to know. What have you got in mind to post about next in the next few days?
So I've got a couple of comments saved. I was just actually traveling for a couple of days. So I made kind of simpler content, more about messaging and trying to avoid hate speech and anti-Semitism and Islamophobia and whatnot. I have a couple more historical posts planned. So I have someone who has asked. So on TikTok, I love responding to comments. I get a lot of comments asking questions. So I have a comment asking about a definition of Zionism. And I've also had that from the American Jewish community, which is something that I knew but kind of could forget sometimes. Which is, there's a whole group of young American Jewish people who don't really know about the word Zionism as a distinction between, you know, an ancient religious concept versus like a modern political movement. Defining Zionism in that first historical context, because when it was first thought up, you know, there was a different concepts and ideas on how it should actually be enacted or whether it should be, and that kind of thing, like, you know, revisionist and reform and all this other stuff. And then versus what it means when someone says it now, which is like a half and half. Like, there's one kind of clump of meanings that it used to have in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And then there's now a whole new clump of meanings and associations that it has in the modern era, or like since the, you know, 60s or 80s or whenever you want to delineate it. To say nothing of one of my favorite Israeli intellectuals, Shlomo Sand, who is an outspoken academic and anti-Zionist. And he discusses a movement that he calls post-Zionism, which is a recognition that Zionism has essentially achieved its goal. And so continuing to reference it as a motivation for everything is kind of anachronistic at this point, which I find fascinating. So that I'm going to talk about that. And then I've always had a plan to kind of do a little more of a historical series discussing the actual history of the region, leading up to the Ottoman Empire, and then from the Ottoman Empire on, which everybody has done a series on that, but it's always really hard to find one that's unbiased one way or the other. So do my best to approach that. And then, you know, a couple others kind of all along those lines, discussing the different ways people just talk about the Nakba, you know, and that kind of a thing, and so on. Yeah. Mm. I did a post on it already, but I do have an ongoing list of safety statements. Do you want to hear the safety statements that I've been putting on all of my posts?
Yes.
Okay. So when I say safety statements, what I just mean is, again, these are not unbiased. I don't want to use that term because that would imply that I think both sides are equivalent. They're not. I do and will always stand for a free Palestine. But I have recently started adding to descriptions of all my posts that Judaism does not equal Zionism. Arab or Palestinian or Muslim does not equal terrorist. One of my favorites is unjustified does not equal unprovoked. And then moving on from the does not equal statements, I say that the situation is not symmetrical, but that doesn't mean there aren't bad faith claims on all sides. And no matter what, be mindful of hate speech and bigotry, because anytime violence in the region escalates, so too does bigotry towards all sides. So no one is ever going to approach a conversation with an open mind if they don't feel safe. So establishing a safe space and moving from there is step zero, you know, before we can even remotely discuss it. So, and I did also have one other person ask about solutions, which is, again, it's kind of fascinating. Like, there's so many people who will shut you down by saying it's too complex, it's too complicated, don't speak on things you don't understand, which is true. But the reality is that there's actually a fair amount of people on both sides. Like Shlomo Sand, the way that he phrases it is that he believes a one state solution is most just, but there will be no one state solution without first establishing a two state solution, because that's the most practical. And I basically think that that's probably fine. Like, when I was a kid and they said two-state solution, I didn't know the details. I imagined North Carolina and South Carolina with like a line down the middle through Jerusalem, you know, it's the same thing as how many Jewish people are told that the land was empty when the Jewish people moved into it. Right. We all had our kind of different things we were told. So I grew up not understanding what would be so was a problem with a two-state solution. But now I kind of understand that, you know, we're like, well, where did the Jewish people go? It's like, well, a one-state solution where everybody's equal would be a lovely step to take instead of having an apartheid with a second-state citizenry, with a second-class citizenry. Those steps are not impossible, and I refuse anybody who says that the current situation is unsolvable. There is a solution. It's just not while Netanyahu's hard right government is in power and actively villainizing an entire group of people, trying to wipe them off the face of the planet and consolidate judicial power in his government. So, you know, we laugh because if we don't, we cry.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's very hard to know where things can go from here and what the fuck is going to happen after this thing, which is underway right now.
Like, I think the playbook that I mentioned way back at the beginning of this conversation, standard one that we all expect and fear is, the constant escalation. So we've already seen evidence of, you know, spillover into Lebanon. We've heard whisperings of possible retaliation from Iran, which it looks like there might be connections to the regime in Iran. all this stuff. So that, I think, in the immediate sense, what comes next, zero people know. There's no way. Mm. And all we can do, any of us can do, is try to prevent the world from forgetting it and moving on and keeping their eyes on it. Call and write your government representatives, urging them to Israel to stop the slaughter of innocent Palestinians. So until then, we just watch and wait and hope for the best and prepare for the worst.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Heavy sigh.
Well, Paul, I appreciate you coming back on and talking to me. Appreciate the education and the awareness raising work that you're doing. I think it's important. I've been very glad to see it sprout legs and glad to see you in various places around the internets. Please keep it up.
Sure. And, you know, it's exhausting. And a lot of other things that I would normally do in addition to posting to TikTok and social media in general are not happening because it's so draining to post about it that I tend to not have the spoons after addressing it and posting about it and trying to be diligent with comment moderation. Mm. So I do appreciate you reaching out. And every time anybody lets me know that they appreciate what I'm doing, it gets a little easier to do it the next time. So I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. 30,000 views. It's not bad.
I mean, yeah, for Instagram. It's a, although I will say TikTok, I have gained followers. I mean, net. Obviously, I've lost and gained some. But I've net gained followers on TikTok, but net lost followers on Instagram since publicly advocating for Palestine. But to be fair, also, most people on Instagram just followed me for some beats. So they were, I think they were the first people to be like, ah, what's this politics? Yeah. So we'll see. We'll see if that turns around.
It's hilarious.
Yeah. Get back to the drumming, Paul. Shut up about all these weird, complicated. Stop choosing sides.
So that was our more recent conversation. I've linked to Paul's socials in the show notes and highly recommend his Palestine content in particular as a good educational resource for people who are new to the conversation. I've certainly been reposting and forwarding it around, as you may have seen. Next up is the episode we'd originally recorded back in August about Paul's Queer Sawana history series, some percussion nerdery, as well as other topics.
And we're recording. Hi, everybody, and welcome. I'm very excited to have today Paul Nabil Mathis, who I found on TikTok after 25 years. Paul and I went to high school together. He is an author and a musician and many other things. And Paul, thank you so much for coming on here and talking to us.
Yeah, it's so wild to be talking to you again.
Literally been 25 years since we spoke last night. And
yeah.
It was wonderful to catch up with you. There's a lot that I'm excited to ask you. And before that, would you mind introducing yourself?
Yeah. So my name's Paul Nabil Mathis. I usually go by Paul Nabil or something like that online. I'm pretty active on Instagram and TikTok. I talk about history, music, and also just kind of whatever I feel like. Specifically North African, Middle Eastern, Swana region, whatever you want to call it, that kind of history and culture. And my mom is Syrian, and my dad's a lovely white man from Texas, and that's kind of it.
Stick. And then, you know, I don't think I was clear, maybe didn't remember so much. Where did you do most of your growing up, or what was your trajectory when you were young? We intersected when you were in 10th grade, and I was, I think, a senior or in 11th grade.
Yeah.
What was your, where did you grow up, and where did you move around to?
Well, I'm originally from Texas, which is where I am now, although I was in Houston at the time, or like a suburb, it's called Sugar Land. And now I'm in San Antonio. But a lot of my family is in Texas, both on both sides of the family. But we left Houston right after my 12th birthday. And I went to go live in Syria for longer than we planned because the visa into Saudi took a little while. Mm-hmm. But we eventually ended up in Saudi for 3 years, mm-hmm. Bahrain for 1 year, Nashville 2 years, outside Memphis 2 years, North Florida 2 years, then LA, you know. So, and I was, you know, most of my adult life was actually in LA. So I moved around a lot, but, you know, who knows where home is. Classic third culture kid stuff.
Yes. Yeah. I think a lot of people who, well, clearly that we went to high school with, but also a lot of people who I've talked to on the podcast have similar struggles around, or not struggles, I think interesting, complex, nuanced stories around where home is.
Yeah. Totally. And there's so many, you know, you meet so many amazing people everywhere you end up, and you just kind of, you know, have them for this little window of your life. Like, I was only in Bahrain for a year, mm-hmm. but that's, you know, that's how we became friends. And, you know, it's just, there's pros and cons to knowing so many people and at the same time not getting to live with these people for like an extended period of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of crazy how you came back into, I don't even know which video of yours it was that floated across my radar. I was like, wait a second, I know this guy. And then I started scrolling through TikTok. I was very, very entertained. It contains all sorts of wonderful things. I think the thing that really caught my eye was all of the drumming nerdery. And I did ask Paul to grab his drum before we started recording. And then just the history, and then your couple of series that you did on women, and then most recently on queer Sawana topics, which I want to get to in a moment. And then the random and really well done history of science nerdery that you throw in. I don't know. I feel like it's a channel that I really, really vibe with. So I want to talk about the queer Sawana series that you did in a moment.
Sure. What
prompted me to reach out to you was the fact that you reposted how one of the queer Muslim groups had listed you as your series as a resource, which I thought was really beautiful, especially in this moment of what's going on now.
Yeah.
And I will say that your wonderful intro video to the series, you do a lot of addressing trolls head on initially, and then also answer the question of like, why this from me and why now, which I really appreciated. And I would love it if you would just talk a little bit about that, about, you know, how even as a cishet man who has a lot of white privilege, why it is that this interested you enough to do a series on it.
It's very kind of testing the waters and seeing what's interesting and seeing what I'm interested in. Mm-hmm. But also it's very much looking around at other people who are talking about the same region and the same history online and seeing what they aren't talking about and mm-hmm. seeing where maybe I could add my voice to something that also should, you know, it fills in the gaps of what's being discussed, you know, because not as many people are talking about it. You know, there's all sorts of ways that you do that. There's, you know, there's kind of like this famous graph where it's like on the x-axis, it's what everybody else likes. And on the y-axis, it's what you like. And you look for like closest diagonal line mm-hmm. so that it's what other people like and what you're interested in, and then like that gives you like the most mm-hmm. sustainable platform, because mm-hmm. if you can everybody mm-hmm. can do something that other people like, but if you hate it, you're not interested in it, you can't keep it going, it'll drive you nuts. Mm-hmm. So I just happened to be fascinated with every aspect of history on my mom's side of the family. Mm-hmm. I grew up visiting Syria and all sorts of historical sites, and you know, all these Crusader castles and Umayyad mosque and Salah ad-Din's mausoleum and all this stuff, Palmyra. And, you know, it was just a very natural progression to be like, well, there's also all this crazy, beautiful history of women and this sort of hyper fluid sexuality that mm-hmm. is kind of hard to nail down in the modern era, and their approach to like intersex people and all sorts of other things. It was just it's just part of their medicine and politics, and I talked about that, except that as soon as I start talking about those same things as it applied to more marginalized people within Arab Muslim society from history, it gets crazy. So mm-hmm. I just, you know, there's a part of me that's just like, well, I want to make sure that I piss off those people at least a little bit mm-hmm. on my platform to make sure that they know where I stand when I'm talking about my historical pride. My mm-hmm. historical pride is inclusive. You know, I don't need to narrow it down to be proud of it.
Mm. Your mom's Christian, right?
Yeah, she was raised Syrian Protestant Christian. My Syrian grandfather is a fairly well-known poet. And my family is very political. Mm-hmm. His name is Ali Ajindi, and you know, it's not a rosy history, but they are known. But their background was Muslim on my mm-hmm. mom's dad's mm-hmm. side, on my grandfather's side. So kind of as one of his many ways of stirring the pot, he happily married a Christian Protestant Syrian. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because he was very much not an organized religion person, the only person in the family who even remotely tried was my grandma, Teta. Mm-hmm. So that means that, you know, even though on the passports, actually, because it comes from the man, it'll list their family as Muslim. Mm. My mom was raised Protestant Christian, and I was raised Methodist Christian because my dad's side has a bunch of preachers, Methodist preachers and stuff. So yeah, I identified as Christian for a long time, but now I just don't consider myself a religious person.
Mm-hmm. So you have a couple of series that you've...
Mm-hmm.
I know there's one about women, and then what was the very first one that you mentioned?
So there were a couple where I kind of like was trying around, but like one was just about maps, you know, whatever.
Maps with an M.
Yeah, maps. Yeah. Naps, okay. Naps would be a good one, too.
It would be.
I mean, social media is exhausting. Welcome to Nap Talk.
I'm writing an essay about biphasic sleep. I have a biphasic sleep pattern, so...
Oh, really?
Naps is a topic of interest. Please continue.
Yeah, go for it. Maps is anarchy. Screw the coffee break. Just go lie down on a couch. No, yeah. So then my first really big one is the Islamic Golden Age, which is a period of about 500 years during the medieval era of the world, the kind of global medieval era. And it was time of intense prosperity and a huge focus on translating a bunch of works from Greeks, Byzantines, India, Egypt, wherever, even a little bit of stuff from East Asia, translating it all into Arabic, the language of the Quran, which they were in love with, and then building on it. And so making their own improvements, comments, discoveries, innovations, whatever. And they were celebrated. The polymaths of the Islamic Golden Age were just unspeakably brilliant people from Arab history, and they're almost always kind of elided over in the, you know, in the histories most people get, especially in the English language. It's just like Greece happened, and then there was some stuff, and then the Italian Renaissance happened, and nothing happened in between, which the reality is that the majority of Italian Renaissance people wouldn't even have had a lot of the Greek texts if they hadn't been preserved by the Arabs.
Right.
So,
right.
And, you know, and obviously, you know, Persia was a huge part of it, huge, huge contributors. And it was just like this massively globally, very diverse, very cosmopolitan existence in the Abbasid Caliphate, kind of just united by, they were all Muslims and people of the book, which is Jews and Christians. It was really just a really cool time. And a lot of people don't know about it. And on top of that, even people who did learn about it, like if they went to school in the Middle East, and, you know, a lot of times it was heavily flavored with like propaganda and all this anti-crusader stuff, very much biased. So a lot of people who even knew the stories were so interested to hear about it from somebody like me, who, you know, kind of has an outside perspective, has a very data-driven focus, which is definitely not the case for a lot of, you know, Arab language schools. So it was a really, it felt really good to be able to like give a lot of those old brilliant scholars a platform.
Fantastic. How long does each video take you to make typically?
Oh, it depends. Used to take longer, but sometimes still, if it's like a really obscure subject, it'll take me, you know, if you count research, it takes, you know, days.
Yeah. I was going to say, like, some of those are very thick with material.
Yeah. They always say try and post every day. I can do that if they're like shit posts, but if they're just like actual content, like I can't do that. I do too much research per post. Some of them will take, you know, days and days to make sure I get it right. But the actual recording of them, it used to take a few hours. Now, if it takes over an hour, that's like a failed recording session.
Okay.
Sometimes it'll take 2 hours, I guess. That's a little bit of a fib, but yeah, used to take a while. Now it's, you get better at it. And I used to write scripts and I stopped using scripts. Now I just go off of like notes and images I've saved for my background. So you get better at it after a while.
Great. Yeah.
Of course, the ones that go viral are the ones that took like, you know, 90 seconds. You know, when you think about it,
so. Yeah. It's really unpredictable, huh?
Yeah. Every time.
So then there's the series on women.
Women of Swana. Mm-hmm. I say Swana, everybody always like kind of gets caught up on it. We just say Swana because it's regional, like Southwest Asia and North Africa. Mm-hmm. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with anything else. If you want to say Middle East, I love the Middle East. Like, it's a great term. It's considered kind of poetic in Arabic. Like, it's totally fine. But I just noticed that, you know, if I say Middle East in a place like TikTok, sometimes people will get a little edgy about it. So like you can, like, you know, Western Turkish people, Iranians, definitely people in the Levant, Israel, Afghan. You know, it gets weird. So I just, especially Northeast Africa, like what part of Sudan, it just gets complicated. So I just keep it regional, mostly just to keep the troll comments away. But Women of Swana, which is North Africa, Southwest Asia, was also something that I heard that a lot of people wanted me to talk about. And if I recall, it was for like Women's History Month, I think. Mm. So it was a series that was about not just during the Islamic Golden Age. I also touched a little bit on pre-Islamic Arabia and I think a little bit after too. But it was, you know, there's warriors. Some of them are mythologized, but, you know, they're all usually generally based on real people. Mm-hmm. Some of them are definitely historical. Some of them are just kind of like, well, this person might not have existed, but their story was very celebrated anyway, which makes them important. Mm-hmm. There were scholars, a lot of poets. Mm-hmm. I kind of shy away from Islamic jurisprudence, but I did mention that there's a lot of quite a lot of the named women we have in Muslim history are mm-hmm. people who were just very good at Quranic jurisprudence and that kind of thing. So, mm-hmm. and that was just a hugely successful series. I felt really good about it. And a lot of young women, they were always commenting, like, how have I not heard mm-hmm. about her, about these stories, about these things? Mm-hmm. And even when I was talking about those stories, like there's maybe the biggest post from that series is about a Cordovan firecracker by the name of Walada bint al-Mustakfi, who was like this, she was queer, she was a hugely successful poet, she was like a, you know, she had political clout, and she was just this brilliant person. She was like a fashion idol, you know what I mean? So like, and a lot of people were so fascinated by the fact that she was openly queer. You know, Cordova has like this very, the needle was always swinging wildly left and right, depending on how progressive the whatever dynasty was in at the time, even within the Umayyad dynasty, whatever rulers. But basically, people were so fascinated that she was openly queer. I was like, it didn't even occur to me, like, oh, I guess people don't know that that was a thing. So I just was like, I guess next we're going to talk about all the really gay shit that went down back then. And some people were like, wow. And some people were like, just blew a fuse. So things all kinds.
Now, I have a curiosity because I mentioned to you yesterday that, you know, I have very mixed feelings about social media. In fact, they're not that mixed. How do you handle the trolls? How do you deal with it? How do you think about it?
Well, first and foremost, it's easier for me because I am a white man. 100%, I watch other people, often more knowledgeable than me, who happen to be women or queer or people of color, or if they're Muslim, you know, all that kind of stuff. I just think that part of it is just that it's just harder to troll me, you know, just because of identity politics. So much of it just kind of washes over, or like, you know, feels useless. But I still get a fair amount of trolls and hate comments and stitches and that kind of thing. Definitely, there's like kind of like a small yet loud contingent of like Israeli ultranationalists, super misogynist, Muslim nationalists, a lot of nationalists, I guess is what I'm saying. And then of course, white people, mostly white men, who they don't even want to hear anything good, or they want to diminish the achievements of this culture, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And at first I didn't block people that much. My mentality was, well, at least it's free engagement and people are arguing. But for mental health purposes, I think eventually you have to start hitting them with the band hammer a little more often. Even beyond that, there are some people who are just so hateful, they're useless. You know, you just, okay, bye, I don't want to see your comment. Especially if they bully my other commenters or if they use slurs, you know, I get that kind of stuff. There's a lot of people trying to rewrite Egyptian history because they want to claim it for themselves, which I'm not Egyptian, but people will just go on. They're so nasty. So I just ban those. Besides that, the hate and whatever, a lot of times you have to be uninformed to have those kinds of opinions. If you knew what you were talking about, you would know that it's just historical date. So a lot of times it's just an opportunity to inform. And every once in a while, in a long while, but it does happen, someone at least actually takes like a response that you say in good faith. And even if it's not, it's very common to say, I know this person isn't going to listen, but I'm going to use this opportunity to tell everybody else. It just happened. I just did a post about, you know, Amazigh people. And, you know, there's a kind of increasingly considered derogatory term, which is Berber, which also exists in Arabic, Barbar, and comes from the word barbarian. So somebody was commenting, it was not really to me, it was just two people arguing. And then one of them was clearly like, was saying like, you know, bigoted things towards the Amazigh person and using Berber, like, as I said in the post, using Berber with the hard R. And so I responded to that, you know, just informing people that, hey, there's a reason that this is actually now considered, because it comes from the word barbarian. That's why we don't really like it. And so the tone of that is, I know this person isn't going to change their mind, but for anybody else who is curious, maybe tries to say Amazigh or Mizigan instead of Berber. And so it's, there's always an opportunity to teach from trolls, even if the troll themselves is not listening. You know what I mean? So try and approach things as like a learning opportunity, even if it's not directed at the person being hateful, I guess. And the rest of it, you know, sometimes just put your phone and walk away for a while.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let them tire their thumbs out.
No, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So then this series, so I watched it the last couple of days, loved it. I loved how you touched on different aspects of queerness and like really showed receipts.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that. Like a couple of highlights from the series for you. Obviously, I'm going to link to it and describe it a little bit in the intro. And what stood out for you?
So completely negating what I said earlier, that series, I probably spent like a good 6 weeks researching it before the beginning of Pride Month. And I did that in particular because another good way to kind of counteract trolls is to have receipts and to make sure that you were really zeroed in on what you can and can't say. Like a lot of people, they tell all these stories that aren't really backed up, that are probably true, for example, but we don't know for sure, versus what we do know more for certain and that kind of a thing. So I really try and avoid apocryphal stories or boosting up things that are probably more like fables than real, those kinds of things. And I think people, even if they're a hater, if they see you doing that, that it'll give them at least a little bit of pause, because it's not so easy then to put you in a box of like, oh, he's like, you know, I have a whole post about how a lot of Arab lesbians look at Umm Kulthum as like a queer icon, even though if you really dig into it, that's almost certainly not true. There's really just more like there's a stigma against musicians in Arab culture. And even though there's a couple of pit photos of her, like, you know, like kissing her women friends, it's just like Arabs just do that, though. That's like
they do.
You know, so it really kind of shorts a circuit if there's nuance that they weren't expecting there. And it's the same thing with that queer series where I have my list, my further readings list, which is every source I cited or even read or referenced or whatever. You know, it's just like there's like, I don't know how many articles are on there, like 60 or something. But it's just a Google Doc. It's free to everybody. And it's just keeping those kinds of records as I move through this, you know, highly sensitive and controversial topic that even if they don't necessarily disagree with it outright, would prefer for it to remain private, things like that, you know. So being able to just always be like, you know, I kept a full list of receipts, just go check the receipts and stop bothering me. That was like very important. In terms of my favorites, I think we talked about yesterday, one of my favorites is I just think not enough people are talking about intersex people. So finding out that there's legal records mostly around inheritance about intersex people in Arab culture. And it would be considered kind of, you know, I'm just going to go and say it's a little shocking how inclusive it is, you know, because looking back, like they cared about that way less than like alcoholism. They're like the alcoholism against the hadith. That you look at, oh, well, that person's body is different. That's so interesting. Let's, you know, let's figure this out with just like some math, you know? So I love stories like that because it's so counterintuitive to what our modern prejudice would like cause us to expect. And I really enjoy, there's kind of a huge obsession with a poet named Abu Nuwas in Arab culture. He's a Bacchic poet. So all of his poems are about like hedonism and wine and sex and stuff. And so there's kind of an obsession with his sexuality in general in the Arab world. And it's, which I did not realize when I first started talking about him. But one of the advantages of having done several series before I did what I consider to be the hardest one out of all of them, which is the Queer Swana series, it gave me a way to talk about him, I think, in a way that considers everybody's approach, even if it's somebody that I don't necessarily agree with. So there's a lot of stuff that leads up to those subjects that I think is that I'm proud of. I guess I'm proud of it, you know, to be able to see how I talked about him 2 years ago when I first started talking about Arab history, Arab Muslim history, versus how I talk about him now, which I'm much more proud of, like the nuance that I'm able to approach those subjects with. So mm-hmm. it's nice to see my own growth in that case.
Did many people reach out to you about it, respond to it directly?
So of the three big Swana history series, the Islamic Golden Age, which is just like Arab Pride, hugely successful. And then Women of Swana, you know, supporting women, also very successful. Queer Swana, it didn't attract as much attention as those other two. Mm-hmm. But like I was mentioning before, also, I noticed that there's one metric on TikTok that you can see really well, which is favorites. Mm. Favorites are secret. Nobody can tell when somebody's favoriting a post. So a lot of people, I think, didn't want to like publicly engage with that stuff. Mm. They didn't comment. They didn't like. They didn't repost. Duet, stitch, whatever. But there were a ton of favorites, which is actually, it's a very bittersweet feeling for me because it's nice to know that people were engaging it in some way and wanted to like come back to it. But also it's a little sad that people don't feel comfortable doing that stuff, like learning about that part of their own history publicly. It's a little tragic. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I hear you. And I think that that's a testament to the meaningfulness of it for a lot of people.
Yeah. It's something, you know, and I can see the stats on my Google Doc that has all the resources and citations and further readings. And a lot of people have looked at that at this point. So, you know, for a couple of weeks after I posted it, there was always people who were like, you know, you can see people are viewing it. You can't see who they are, but you can see that there is somebody looking at it. So that was good. That went on for a while after that series was over. So I was like, oh, okay. So people are interested in this. That's good to know. But there's clearly a lot of nervousness about it.
Yeah.
And I think I also mentioned that some people reached out to me being like, you can't talk about this publicly, or take that document down. They'll find you. They'll trace you back, whatever. And I was just like, it's fine.
I mean,
it's all anonymous. I promise it's all anonymous.
So interesting. So, I mean, that's pure paranoia, right? Like people tracking who accesses a Google Doc, or is it? You know a little bit about this.
Yeah. I mean, paranoia is a part of it for sure. But I mean, I think it's just like naivete. Like, you know, it's many people don't know how data tracking works. And it is like somebody who messaged me with that stuff, you know, like, you know, they didn't message me directly, but somebody else, it was like some data privacy person. And like, it was like a game of telephone where like, they didn't quite get the message that their friend had said, but they reached out to me and they were like, you have to take that doc down. Someone will, no, you can't have any communities based around this because it would put them at risk for persecution in their home country. And I was like, okay, yeah, but that's, Google Doc is not a community. I promise. If I had started a Discord based on this, then absolutely other people could hop in and see what like just like the welcome messages were. But something, I'm careful not to do stuff like that. I don't want to get people in trouble.
Interesting.
You know? I have a history, you know, of cybersecurity and web dev and all that stuff. I'm careful. I promise. Everybody listening, you're safe with me. You know,
I'm just curious because I've talked to a lot of people who have navigated being queer and engaging with communities or other people, or not engaging with communities or people in different parts of the world where it is not just stigmatized, but also illegal, and where there's entrapment and things like that. So I don't know. I'm just interested in how people think about it and are thinking about it, especially now in this moment.
Yeah, I definitely have a thought on that, especially I just did a post about the kind of open secret of queer culture in Saudi Arabia, which I lived in for 3 years, which not just, you know, many countries in that region have a similar kind of thing. A lot of people talked about like India and Pakistan and all stuff too. You know, it was interesting too, because I actually got several commenters from Saudi on that post. And I think it was because, first of all, it was an article that already existed. And I think because no point was I ever trying to like inject my own opinions there, really. I was kind of just like taking people through this article about, because men are just always hanging out together and it's hard to hang out with women, there's all these opportunities to like, you know, hook up basically with other men that they don't have with women. And it was an interview with somebody in Saudi who was taking somebody around two locations in Saudi, that kind of thing. They were kind of like fine, honestly. They were just like, oh, yeah, this is actually a thing that happens. And they were comfortable talking about it. And as long as nobody's trying to come for you, people, if they feel like they're being invited to talk about it in a space where they're not going to be like judged or like no one's going to try and dox them or something, then yeah, you know, they're ready to talk about it. Mm. So it's just a delicate subject. It's not necessarily a death sentence, you know?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. Speaking of which, there was one of the series that you called The Culture of Privacy.
Yeah.
Two things stood out to me from that one. You talked about how your mom is one of your historical consultants on a lot of this material.
Yes.
And her reaction, her response to this one was interesting. This was the one where she was like, why are we talking about this?
Yeah, very much. It's a comment I get from a lot of people. And the thing is they're, in a way, they're very right. In that sense, the urge to talk about it in such a public space is very much... You know, I use the word Western because I just no one's been able to give me a better term yet. But the Western influence, whatever you want to call it, European, North American influence, that's absolutely what it is, 100%. Like Arab culture is a very private culture. It's based around that. It always has been.
Mm.
And Southwest Asia, South Asia also, a lot of cultures, wherever you go, privacy, like we're the weird ones who are always trying to like fly our stupid individualism flags, you know,
right.
like it's absolutely outside influence that makes us do that. Mm-hmm. But the difference there is leads to ignorance. First of all, it leads to this path where a lot of people don't know their own history at all, which is, you know, people should know their history. That's just part of having an ancestry in any sense and being more informed and not opening yourself up to propaganda where they can white, you know, whitewash or Arab wash or oligarchy or Orthodox wash, whatever wash they're doing. You know, you can learn to resist that better if you know the actual facts of where you're from and what, and
or straight washing,
all of that. Yeah. All straight washing, exactly, which is definitely what they're doing. And in addition to that too, it's also like that community is missing. That you can build your communities on the socially acceptable ones, politically acceptable, whatever you want to say. But then there's also these other communities that you might be ostracized for because you're supposed to keep it private, but that you want to be a part of that community too. And so a lot of people, for whatever reason, in the modern age are becoming lonelier and lonelier. Social media, online stuff, and all various reasons. That's another conversation. But loneliness and vitriol is on the rise, I think. And a really good way to combat that and to keep people safe from the dangers of extreme loneliness and depression is to help them find community. And it's just going to be really hard for you to convince me, Mom, that who is probably going to watch this or listen or whatever when it comes out. It's going to be hard for anybody to convince me that it's a bad thing to try and make people feel comfortable enough with something that was historically kept private, which many people consider to be sensitive enough subject that it should be kept private, but that a lot of people who are ostracized in their larger community should be able to find a different community that accepts them just for who they are. I think that's it. I want to be a part of, I want to be on the right side of history of, you know, helping people learn about their own ancestry and heritage and helping them feel accepted in some kind of community when so many other ones want to just shun them just for who they want to be with or live their lives as or whatever.
Yeah. So South Asians are the same. And you're reminding me of something that happened in the last couple of years where I was visiting my dad and, you know, he has dinner with a friend of his every Saturday night. And that particular Saturday, they always try to wriggle out of it because, you know, a couple lines into the conversation and, you know, the questions start. But I know this friend and he's respectful. But my dad is like, okay, but this friend is, his wife is coming. So you have someone to talk to. And I'm like, Dad, like.
Oh, no.
I'm like, come on. Like, do you have no idea why this is uncomfortable for me? He's like, no, why? And I was like, well, the questions start. He's like, you know how to handle them. And I was like, okay. And here's the thing, Dad. You're kind of making an assumption that I think I have something to be ashamed of that I'm going to handle. And I really don't think that I do.
Yeah.
And so I'm not going to act like I have anything to be ashamed of. And I was hoping that would get me out of dinner. And he was like,
okay then. As in, like, okay, if it comes up, like, talk to them about it. And I was like, shit, now I have to deal with this.
Yeah, that's a very obnoxious form of progress.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm very fortunate. Both my mom and my dad are both just incredible people, super accepting. I didn't have to deal with them, like, judging my friends or any of that crap along the way. They're lovely. And my mom, when she brings up those kinds of things, isn't bringing it up really too so much from her own prejudices. It's just she's worried about me. Yeah. She's worried about the trolls coming for me, you know.
Yeah.
And so I just like, mom, I'm fine.
So can I ask something? There was something you alluded to in that video. I forget what the topic was, but there was one that she didn't want you to talk about at all. Which one was that?
Oh, no, wait. So it's come up a couple of times. You might be thinking of Zar, the Zar ritual.
Yes, that's it. That's the one.
Yeah. Arab love them to death. Arabs and Muslims and whatever are a superstitious bunch, you know. And my mom does not like anything that even kind of smacks of like black magic, jinn ritual, any of that stuff. And so she heard about Zar and she was like, no, you can't talk about that. That's the evil eye. That's bad. That's no good. And it's like, mom, it's a beat. It's chill. And, you know, like that Zar is huge right now in Northeast Africa, Egypt especially. And it's just it's a great beat. Like there's a reason it's been around for like 1,000 years or whatever. Like it's because it slaps. It's the one where I was like, yeah, this beat is scientifically fire. It was reached by a process of scientific elimination of just which dance is the hardest. Ayub when it's fast, which is Sufi, and it's Zar when it's slow, or at least when it starts slow, which is the name of the beat is also the name of the ritual, the Zar ritual. So she didn't like that at all. She did not want me to go there, but I was like, it's just drumming. I promise it's fine.
Okay, so that brings us to your percussion nerdery, which
true.
I am not a musician. I am probably one of those people who is rhythmically challenged, and I love your drumming videos. I love them. I love the
thank you.
The thoughtfulness behind them, the deep nerdery that you clearly evince about this thing that you're really passionate about. I mean, I don't know how much I retain, but they're wonderful and fascinating and just really mesmerizing to watch. So you went to undergrad for music, right?
Yeah. So thank you for the kind words. You're too kind. So I actually have drummed in various ensembles throughout my life, but my degrees are in music composition, and usually my instrument was more voice than anything else. I was never really like a serious drummer, but I have done it. I'm a little bit of a multi-instrumentalist guy, so I've got a couple of them under my belt. But my mom bought me my very first darbuka, drubeke, Arab goblet drum, when I was 12, when that first time we moved to Saudi. She got it as kind of like a consolation prize because we were stuck in Syria waiting for a visa. So she was like, here, just go make a bunch of noise. So I've been playing them forever. You know, driving my family nuts. So. Like I told you, I've given a couple talks now about the history of Arab rhythm because there's a lot of focus on Arab scales, but less so on iqaat, which is the rhythms, the traditional rhythms, of which there are like hundreds of these things. And they're regional. And so Syria and Egypt have their kind of shared entertainment industry ones. And then there's Khalij and Iraq and, you know, obviously Maghreb. So like North Africa, Moroccan, Algeria, they have all these beautiful, beautiful rhythmic traditions. So I just started posting about those because I love it. And the very first one I posted, I wanted to make it kind of historical. So I added text on the top, kind of give some context about what I was playing. In addition to, you know, some of them I do traditional, but other ones I do like these trap beats or whatever. Yes. You know, so it's just like, which is something I love. And it's also, I guess people, they like, you know, it's like you're just providing a score and then the text, the history they're reading is about the score that they're hearing. And it's just, you know, it's fun. It's a nice little multimedia learning experience. So
the one you did about Armenian folk music.
Yeah.
Gave me chills.
Yeah. Oh man. The whole history of that is just, it's wild, the story behind that and how it was preserved. And there was like this musical genius who just
barely was preserved.
Able to,
Yeah.
Yeah, barely. So, and it's a beautiful, you know, it's like a 5 or 10 count, and it's very unique and brilliant. So, yeah.
To the extent that would feel good to you, I would love if you felt up for it, of course.
You want to hear some?
Introduce us to a couple of your favorites, like walk us around the Sawana region, whatever you want to do.
Okay. So this is not the drum my mom bought. I have a newer Egyptian one. So shout out to Gohadet. This is my new drum. But it's so the thing you need to know, I love that we're like transitioning from like all these like super serious subjects to like, now here's some beats. but I mean, you know, dancing, like people, I don't know. I feel like people need to understand how much Arabs dance about like everything they can. Mm-hmm. So it's just such a huge part of the culture. And there's all this stuff about music is sinful or dance is sinful. And definitely a lot of like, you know, conservative Muslims will say that too. But on the flip side of that, it's just like, okay, but also dancing is great. So how about you hush?
and it's been around for a very, very, very long time.
Yeah, since literally forever. So this drum, I don't know if people will be able to see it, but this is an hourglass shaped drum.
You know what?
Which is,
I'm gonna take a screenshot of you. Here we go.
Yeah,
there we go. Yes.
So it's important to keep in mind because this drum, it's shaped like an hourglass or a goblet, usually a little wider on top than at the bottom. There's a billion different versions of it, but this is literally one of the oldest drums that we have any historical archaeological record for. There's like pictures of them, and there's a lot of theories that in the really old days they were a bowl that they would use for like eating, and then when eating was done they would stretch an animal skin over it and just beat it, and that was like their drum. So super old tradition. Everybody had them because it's just like parallel innovation. They were in Europe and everything too, and they are particularly good in high heat because the heat actually, they just make them out of clay or metal, which is heat resistant. And then it makes the skin on the top tighter. So in these really hot desert areas or whatever, all their other whatever things would get ruined when it got really hot, except the drum would sound even better the hotter it got. So it just lasted forever. The way that the rhythms are transmitted from one person to the next is, if you've ever heard of, you know, the conical system or South Asia, so like the Takatimi and that kind of a thing, it's like that, but like way, way, way simplified. Instead of, you know, being, you know, 100 or 70, however many syllables there are in that system, you know, there's just like a handful of them. Then the really basic ones are Dum and Tak. So Dum is the center and Tak is the edge. That just builds the whole system. And then you have in between ones. So there's a ka, so dum tek ka. And that's kind of like the in-betweeny rim. And then there's a couple other words. So like there's like a muted one, like, which is like they'll say different ones, different terms for it. And then there's also a sak or something, which is going to be the silence in between a rhythm. But basically with that basic framework, you can just define these hundreds of different rhythms that have been passed down towards time. So the most popular one by far, it's actually a family of rhythms, which is the Beledi family. So it'd be called Beledi or Maksum or Masmoudi, or Masmoudi Saghir. And then there's also Nawari, which is, the nice word for them is nomads. So that's how I translated it, is nomads. But they're all based on this basic pattern. I grew up with Maksum, which goes dum tak tak dum tak dum tak dum tak dum tak dum tak, and then we add ornamentation, and that would be a rap. But it always stays with that dum tak tak dum tak. Right. A lot of times you'll actually see performers having the basic pattern just playing on like a loop in the background, and then they just go nuts like soloing. Right. In that Beledi family, you would change it around. So instead of doom tak tak doom tak, like say you could make it doom doom tak doom tak, which is a different rhythm. Right. So it's like doom doom tak doom tak doom doom tak doom then they changed it again, so you get doom tech, doom doom tech, like. And they just have so much fun with it. And it can get really, really nuts. So that one I just did is a 4-count. Mm-hmm. And then Ayub Urzar is a 2-count. So it's shorter. Mm-hmm. And it's literally just doom, takum, tak, doom, tak, tak, doom, tak, tak, doom. So doom. But that one, especially in the Sufi tradition, they start out with it like really slow. So it just like, and then slowly over the course of 10 minutes or an hour or whatever, mm-hmm. they'll just slowly speed it up. And just by the time you get to the end of it, they're just going. And it's one of the craziest, most infectious things, you know. Like, and then, they'll go following up. It's one of my favorite things in the world. Mm. And then I can do. And then, of course, there's one of my favorite ones to talk about, which is the Maghribi ones. So that's North African. That's like the Moroccan, all those things. Morocco especially. So like Shaabi, you know, they have all these words and they're kind of very close to like folk or the people or, you know, rustic, rural, whatever you want to call it for the translation. And then so Shaabi Maroc or Moroccan, particularly the popular one that comes from Morocco. And Morocco has a very strong influence from West Africa. So there's kind of like this huge, several intersecting musical traditions coming on there. And the result is a really cool, they use this word all the time. They say it's more trance-like than like an Arab, like more like, you know, Peninsular Arabs or Levantine or whatever. And their thing is they hide where the downbeat of the rhythm is. It's like my favorite game. So it's a really hard beat. So if anyone's listening and I mess it up, I'm sorry. But it's counted not in 4 or 8 or any of those things, it's counted in 6 or 12, which means it has a like it goes, so that kind of a thing. And the actual pattern of it in that doom tech pattern is tech doom tech doom tech doom kek boom kek boom kek boom. The trick of that is if you try and count that out without knowing what it like what the actual count is, it'll just mess you up every time. Like, so we go one. It's like one. One. So it's just a very, very hard one to count, but it's so fun to play. So sick. Oh my god. I could play it forever. And I'm not even great at it. And also it's a little more polyrhythm, which is also a West African influence. So it actually as I understand it, it sounds a little wrong just played like that. It needs like another instrument playing this kind of 4 pattern that makes it sound really, really wild. So yeah, those are my favorite ones, I think.
That's fun. Thank you for that. Not bad for a consolation prize for moving you when you were 12.
Yeah. I am looking for actual lessons because I'm still self-taught and some of my approaches are not like technically the way you're supposed to play them. And there's these techniques like split finger technique and stuff that I don't use that I should and all those kind of things. So I am actually kind of like low-key looking for like private lessons so I can actually be taught how to play this thing, you know, instead of just faking it and doing my best.
So faking it rather well, and like I would not have known.
I do have actually some other professional players of the Darbuka who have reached out to me and been like, hey, that's great, you have a really interesting style and we're like friends now and stuff. So it's a little bit of validation for a little young Syrian boy in of 12.
Where in Syria, just out of curiosity?
So mostly Damascus, pretty much so. Yeah, my mom's family is Ajindi. Ajindi is they're a known family for a lot of people. They're based mostly out of a little town called Selamiye. They moved around a little bit, like they were in Homs for a while as well. But definitely, for the most part, my mom considers Damascus her hometown. And when we go to Syria, Damascus is also like where we mostly stay. We'll go to Aleppo and a couple other of the spots, but Damascus more or less for sure.
So I want to ask about your writing before we wrap
sure.
up. Yeah. So you have a book that you've got an agent. It's sci-fi set in the Arab world. Tell me about it. Tell us about it.
Yeah. So the current title is Aleph Rising, which I say that because I like the title, but sometimes the publisher will have other suggestions. So it's whatever, but it's called Aleph Rising. I have an agent, Spielberg Agency. My agent is a lovely person named St. Gibson, and it's currently being read by some publishers. That's a relatively recent development in the publishing industry slow. So I would love if I get a release date of like next year or something, but who knows? As of right now, I'm just waiting. It's a futuristic, apparently the industry term is techno thriller because it's all about computers and AI in like a near future. The climate collapse has already happened, and nobody ever talks about how climate collapse is going to affect the Arab world. So in my book, you know, we kind of figure it out. Humans destroy everything, and then they in order to kind of finally try and take humans out of the equation, they put a bunch of AI in place to help govern the world and fix things. And I work in AI, right? I do software. So it's not like Skynet. There's not like robots who decide to randomly kill everybody. Yeah. Instead, it's just a world that sort of functions, but also it's just full of bugs. Like bugs, like most of human effort is just getting rid of the bugs that run the planet. And so the main character is a Syrian man who is a star, like a rock star bug finder guy who's obsessed with puzzles. And it's like a you know, cyberpunk noir sort of thing. A beautiful woman drops a puzzle into his lap that resulted in a death that was covered up, which is supposed to be impossible in a fully surveilled Arab world. And so it takes him on this journey, not just of like investigating the world, but also he finds out that it's heavily influenced by like the Arabic language and like what happens if you like were to start training these AI on like Arab history and Arabic language and Arab poetry and stuff unchecked. And so he has to like track down how that happened and how to deal with it. So it's definitely a love letter to one of my favorite cities in Syria. I used to go to Latakia all the time. So it's actually set in New Latakia. It's like New Tokyo, but New Latakia. And I used to go there all the time with my grandfather to like, we would stay at the Meridian. And, you know, he would like give me sips of Carlsberg when my mom wasn't looking and all this stuff. So, yeah. And it's, you know, it's very Arab. People, when I describe this book, sometimes people are like, okay, so what's happening in America in this world? And I'm like, I don't know. It's not relevant. It's irrelevant to the story. maybe in a sequel, they'll end up in North America, but it has no pertinence to the tale as it's written. So. So yeah, so that's the tale, and I'm pretty hopeful about it. We'll see how it goes. Hopefully it gets picked up, everything crossed. And I'm also writing a children's book, actually. It's about an Iraqi-American from Southeast Texas, and it's a time travel story. So it's actually middle grade, so it's like a little younger than young adult. But it's kids lit. And it's the main character's name is Sarah Shamps, and she discovers that the House of Wisdom was not destroyed, but became a part of like this kind of otherworldly jinn world area. And so she's conscripted by the failing House of Wisdom to travel through time and save a bunch of lost books from Arab history. That's what I'm working on right now. We'll see how it goes. That's like a fresh manuscript right now.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah. So we'll see how that goes. I've been writing novels since forever. I mean, I wrote my first book when I was in like fifth grade, but they only started getting good maybe about like 5 or 6 years ago. So, and then I finally just got an agent last year. So we'll see how it goes.
Funny what age can do.
I know, right? Oh my gosh. Yeah. Sometimes when I'm feeling sad, you know, I'm 41. Sometimes when I'm feeling sad, I go and look at those those blog posts, those inspirational blog posts people make of like, well, Sam Jackson wasn't cast in his first movie until he was 46 or whatever, you know. You know, I was just like, I just need to see those just to like stop the constantly encroaching threat of midlife crisis that always looms in my shadow. Like, it's fine, everybody at their own pace.
Oh, you know, that's so good. Paul, thank you so much for coming on here and talking to me. It was really beautiful to catch up with you and to, you know, hear you talk about your life and the things that you post about and, you know, engage in some drum nerdery with you. So thank you so much for being here.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm just here for the drums. So queer everything.
As always, thank you so much for listening. It's important for us to platform voices on this podcast that are less represented, including queer voices from the Muslim world, the Global South, and the Middle East. To be clear, we are vociferously against homonationalism and pinkwashing being used as justification for occupation and genocide, and we've posted some highlights about this on our Instagram account as resources. We are unapologetically queer, as in Free Palestine.